Hello, I am Mike Matthews, and this is Muscle for Life. Thank you for joining me today for a new episode, which is an interview with Dr. Kelly Starrett, who is a doctor of physical therapy, a renowned speaker, a New York Times bestselling author who has written several books. And I first encountered Kelly, at least his work, with his book, Becoming a Supple Leopard, which made him into the biggest mobility guru in the world. And as great as Becoming a Supple Leopard is, many people have found it difficult to use or difficult to apply to their circumstances because it is encyclopedic. There's so much in there, so much to choose from. I've heard from many people over the years who were looking for something a bit more prescriptive or who were asking me to help them understand for their shoulder issue, which of the 35 mobility drills or exercises are going to work best for them. And so in Kelly's newest book, Born to Move, he has taken those questions to heart and produced something that allows you to assess your current ability to move your body the ways that it should be able to be moved and find where you have deficits. You're going to have strengths, you're going to have weaknesses, and then figure out which exercises can help you shore up those weaknesses. And so in this episode, Kelly is going to talk a bit about this book, but he's also going to talk about a topic that he's very passionate about, and that is sport. And particularly the transformative power of sport, how we can use it to not only train our body, but also train our mind, and how powerful that can be with young people in particular, how kids can learn very important life lessons and develop very important character qualities through sport, and that sport may be the most effective way to develop those qualities and to teach those lessons and to train their bodies. Hey, Kelly, it's nice to see you again. It's been a while.
Always a pleasure, my friend. You have been busy.
Yeah. As you have been writing books and so forth, which I want to get into in this interview.
We are right in the middle of Junior Olympic madness. We're about to head south. Our kids play water polo. I have a daughter at orientation at University of Michigan. We're just trying to figure out how to throw all the balls in the air like everyone else, catch most of them and not implode. So, you know, just like we're an average busy working people where we spend 3 hours a day on our gratitude journal and my red light therapy. And then I
don't forget the cold plunge and
All right. I'm just trying to fold the laundry before my wife gets home. That's my game.
If only we didn't have to sleep, or if we could just take small doses of methamphetamine without losing our teeth.
You know, what's cool about that is that experiment's been run for us already, and it always ends in disaster. One of our friends, Alan Lim, who has worked in, he's the founder of Scratch Labs, Tour de France. He's a genius sports performance maestro, but he always says you cannot cheat your physiology. And I really always come back to that. I'm like, you know, what are you stealing from? What are you borrowing from? And that, you know, that short-term gain, you're like, this is working. And then you run out and you fall to your death. So you don't get something for nothing.
That's very true. Very applicable to the body composition scene, of course, with steroid use a lot more prevalent, I think, than many people realize, even just among everyday gym goers who don't even have a good reason, like millions of dollars on the line to use those drugs.
Yeah, that's an interesting piece. Without, you know, you're not going down this rabbit hole, really does speak to, I think, some of the work that you and I are trying to do is give people a different rationale for why they're training besides aesthetics. And look, that's always there. And whatever gets you to the gym, I think that's super cool.
At least 50% of the reason remains vanity. that's fine. There's no shame in admitting that.
I want to be less gross for my wife. I think that's a reasonable thing. But you know, what you really are seeing is how this sort of battle for aesthetics, I look a certain way, has no bearing on longevity, durability, has no tangible relationship to performance. And, you know, all show, no go. We've been talking about that forever, but we've really lost the idea of why am I training and bodybuilders, don't get me wrong. We have a bunch of bodybuilder friends and we have learned how to manipulate calories and have discipline and, you know, put on mass on people fast. I mean, there's a lot we've pulled out of those communities, but once again, that's not a sport. I think when we try to really understand why we're engaging on all of these seemingly very disparate behaviors, It's so that we can go out into the world and be a different person. We can be more effective. We can show up for our families. We can be more resilient. What made me think of it actually was we were just running the South Fork this weekend, South Fork of the American. Juliet is a three-time world champion. My wife is a three-time world champion whitewater paddler. I used to paddle professionally, canoe and kayak, but I went through this drop, this little class 3+ drop called Satan's Cesspool, because they always have a name like that. But I'm in a new boat and it kept me completely dry. Shout out Narvana Jackson Kayak, and it has this bow that really allows you to get up. And I came flying through there with more speed, dry face, and Juliet had parked herself on River Right in the middle of the drop where she shouldn't have been. And I smashed into her boat going so fast, all of my 109 kilo self flying down, smashed into her boat, and literally was like a dynamic undercut. Like my wife had created an undercut. I got pushed under the undercut off of rebounding, and I rolled back up and I was like, wow, is my neck broken? Like, what? Well, that was a lot. And Julia's like, you hit us so hard. And that really is sort of, I'm like, okay, I guess my training is working. A, I got lucky. And B, there's some things that I'm doing that's allowing me to take the hits. And I think that's where you and I love to, you know, some of our overlap is we don't just think you can be better in your life, but we think that these behaviors allow you to take the hits which are coming out of left field. You don't know what's popping up, and you can reduce the impact of those hits. Big job interview, stress, sick loved one, a move, a death, like an injury, like the hits are coming.
That's exactly what I was going to say. For many of us, myself included, physical hits like that are less likely because I have no hobbies and I just lift weights a few days a week. However, the emotional and the psychological hits, even in the most charmed of lives, it is inevitable. And there's no question that there's overlap between physical resilience, or that physical resilience improves our psychological and emotional resilience. Although I think it can reach levels of cringe on social media, where you see guys, it's usually guys, talking about training as if it's hand-to-hand Mortal Kombat, like as if they're like Roman legionnaires in Julius Caesar's army or something. It can get a little bit like overly alpha and cheesy, but there's at least a kernel of truth there.
I'm doing this bench press at 225 to inspire the world. That's obviously...
Or going to battle. I'm going to battle with the bench press.
That's right. You know, you're hitting up, I think, is there is some innate need to do difficult things. And more, I have sometimes a complicated relationship with sport. Sport is commoditized. It is fetishized. It is monetized in a way that is really gross and a turnoff sometimes. And we take athletes and we sell them this lie that, you know, get to college, get to pros, everything will be good. You'll make billions of dollars, and someone's making billions of dollars, but athletes have paid a heavy price, heavy blood price for that access. And if you're talking to young, you know, teenagers whose parents have said, you know, you're going to be the chosen one, and then that either turns out or doesn't turn out, or it doesn't, you know, you got there for one, got to the dance or a dance for one year. Certainly that is not the promise of sport. And yet right now I've seen sport unite cities in such a profound way when we're our most divided selves in this country, where it doesn't matter what your affiliation or cultural background or religious identity, we are cheering for the Warriors. We are cheering for the Niners. And that is really, really powerful. When the Olympics comes around, I'm like, oh, this is what it felt like to be an American after 9/11 again, where we, you know, and I know Sebastian Younger has written about that, but suddenly I start to think, well, how else are modern kids going to come to have a model to understand themselves? And sport really gives us a way to understand how we work with other people and how we can engage with self-soothing techniques and how do I handle stress and then be goofy the next second? And what does it mean to delay gratification? Suddenly you're like, oh, there's training, there's nutrition, there's mindset, there's recovery, there's sleep. And if we reframe this for everyone, suddenly we have, I think, the greatest tool to make a better society. And I don't feel like I'm just being, you know, Pollyanna-ish. I really am like, that is the promise of sport, not the promise of that I'll get to, you know, I heard about a university that just won a national championship in a sport and they're dominating. and a really well-known university you've heard of, and the culture on the team is toxic. The people competing on that team aren't stoked to be there. And yet they've done the thing. They've won the national championship. They're the best. You know, what you see is the experience is teaching me that this thing can't be all things. And I feel like that's really, if we can reframe sport, maybe get away, you know, some of the shininess, look at the guy's big pecs, that's the goal, then suddenly we have a really, do have a way to transform families and transform our communities. I think that's what we're going to have to do a better job of.
And in the case of kids and sport, if you could press the button, how would that relationship change, or how would the focus change, or how would the representation of sport change to young kids?
Oh, it's such a great question. I think there are a lot of really smart people working on sort of the scope of that, because suddenly what we see is we have an amateur system of play, theoretically, right? Which suddenly becomes not very playful. It's very intense, very on you. But, you know, I'm talking about your 10-year-old's elite pitching experience. I'm like, he's 10, he hasn't grown yet. You know, we'll see. But a lot of the coaches, volunteer coaches, are parents. I think this is the one errors we have in the whole system, is that it's all volunteer-based in the beginning. And those volunteers default to their own experience and to their own training, which means I had a football coach yell at me, so that's obviously how I motivate kids. Where in there now are we going to talk about all of the things required to be successful at sport? Why do we eat the way we eat? Why do we have to get enough sleep? So suddenly we're at this another type one error where, if kids aren't playing sports regularly and active and outside, then they're not prepared to go learn a new skill. So ultimately, where am I developing GPP, general physical preparedness, functionality? Where am I loading tendons and ligaments and teaching movement skills? So then the kid can then go transfer those to soccer. And so suddenly the soccer coach now is responsible for ACL prevention. They're talking about warm up and cool down. They're teaching kids to run. Like, you know, their task isn't just to organize kids to be effective in a soccer match. They're suddenly having to take on a whole different level of responsibility to get that child and support that child, which may mean, man, hey, what did you have for breakfast, Johnny? Can I see your snack? Suddenly you were like, you know, hey, a Gatorade is not a great thing to drink in the middle of a practice. You know, you may really only need an orange slice and some water, but you actually didn't eat breakfast and you had pizza. Like, you can suddenly see the run on. So suddenly we ask, well, who's responsible for the GPP? Where is that being taught? And it's not being taught. And subsequently now, we add in this sports specialization model and kids are playing one, they're only playing baseball. And the message they're getting is, if you're not only playing baseball, you'll never start. So suddenly we've taken this beautiful possibility and we've certainly tweaked it in a way where it's not serving us the way we know. And the research around kids dropping out by the time they're 18 is pretty high. And so let me give you an example. I have this 15-year-old daughter who's 5'10". She likes to play goalie. She self-identifies as a goalie. She's very motivated. She plays water polo. And, you know, she had an opportunity because of her birthday, weird birthday works. She is going to be a sophomore, but she has the opportunity to play at Junior Olympics with seventh and eighth graders, even though she's a rising sophomore. She's already played varsity, but her birthday, she's still 14 until August 2nd. So her birthday is the day of the cutoff where she can play down. And one of the well-meaning coaches said to her, you should play 14 because you'll be scouted and you'll dominate those 14-year-olds. Caroline has no relationship, doesn't go to school with those kids, doesn't practice with those kids, doesn't psycho-identify with those kids. She's in high school and she plays with all these high school kids, and her older sister is best friends with all these kids. So the reason she should be playing 18U, where she's playing right now, as a fluke of not having enough goalies or whatever, and she's got some talent, she also is with her cohort of friends. And so it's that psycho-emotion. She goes to practice and comes home giggling and buzzing and talking about practice, not, I dominated the crap out of these 14-year-olds. The rationale of understanding why we're doing sport so that we can come to know ourselves, that is the thing we're going to have to do a better job of teaching parents. And I think what that does mean is that we can do a better job as parents to bring kids in, if parents have the right tools, and say, this is what athletes do to sleep, to grow. This is what athletes eat to perform. And why? Because we're actually going to take all of the lessons that we're learning in high-performance environments and transmute them to our kids, so our kids can actually benefit from what we're learning in the NFL, NHL, MLB, Premier Soccer, et cetera, et cetera.
I've seen some of this firsthand with my son, who's 10 and wanted to play flag football. So did one season, then the next season I chipped in to help coach, and it was interesting. So as a kid, I played baseball and then I got into hockey, first roller hockey, then ice hockey, and then really liked ice hockey and just stuck with it for a number of years and did a lot of it. Between that and roller hockey, that was like a lot of my time. So I'm coaching my son's, assistant coaching my son's flag football team. And it was interesting. I remember one kid actually had some athletic ability, but spent most of his time, his parents just let him sit on screens. Basically, that's all he did outside of school. And so like, if he dropped a ball, he would start crying. Like he didn't know how to deal with even a minor setback because he didn't really have much of a social, maybe he had his little friends at school, but otherwise like would just go home and sit on TikTok and sit on video games. And then if he dropped another ball, then there were times he would pretend like he would have a leg cramp, he'd have to sit out, but it was totally not. He didn't know how to cope with this feeling of, wait a minute, it didn't go the way I wanted it to. There were other kids, nutrition, you know, they hadn't eaten in 6 hours and it's like 6 p.m. and it's practice time. And I would ask them. And the last thing they did eat was like a Lunchables. And there are these mini bites or something like little muffins. And they ate it 6 hours ago. And so I've seen that firsthand. And
one of our friends recently had this idea for a sports drink for middle-aged people. And it's hose flavored water. So you just pour a little hose.
But it has to have a bunch of sodium and a couple of other minerals. So then you can mark it up like 15 times and sell it as
100%. So hose flavored water, everyone. And because, you know, really that's the allegory for all of the dysfunction that we fought through to create these calluses that allowed us to go out and take chance and risk as escape from, you know, uncertainty is an escape. Like this, where I was like, okay, there's an adult who's here who wants to like guide me. Universe is like, don't come home till it's, you know, it's dark. What I think we're realizing here is the sport is almost the canary in the coal mine, where we really, you do see, you know, the downstream effects. You're at the pointy end of the spear, of the stick as a coach. And where are we going to begin? Because now we have the perfect opportunity for a short series, a short season. Everyone knows what the outcome is, which is to feel good and be on a team. And you've seen all the great work that in all the sporting groups do that I'm blanking on the name. I apologize for everyone. But you know, we're trying to get parents through to learn what it means to be a good parent, about coaching. But one of the drills that we do with this group is you write your five favorite characteristics of a good coach, and then you put them up on a wall. And some of them are physical, like tactical, excellent, technical knowledge. And then you have all these psycho-emotional components. And when you put everyone's on the wall, there's like 50 on this side about psycho-emotion, how they made you feel, communication, right? Belong to a team, felt loved, felt seen. And then there's like 3, like technically great coach. What we see in the work of people like Brett Bartholomew, who's talking at Art of Coaching about communication, is that, wow, we really don't value some of the other aspects of sport. We value, I need another drill, not how am I going to get buy-in, manage all of these different relationships. And we see it, the mal-expression in so many different ways. One of the teams that I am associated with, I get to spend time with, they had a bad loss to another college this year. And then that affected them in the next game that they should have won. It was a bad loss, lost their confidence. What we saw was potentially we had a generation of athletes who had been the best, put through the junior national team system, promoted along the way, always selected for the A team, never always been successful. And then the first time they actually competed against people who had been the same thing, and lost, they didn't have a schema. This is Division I superstars having a leg cramp because they dropped the ball. And so what you really do see is you're like, oh, I see how this is. And sometimes when you come in, you say, well, what can we control for? On our site right now, on our Instagram, we have pinned a video I put up. I was on our friend's show talking about sleep. And I said on this Instagram post, and if you can go there to the Ready State, you can see it. I said, hey, really, we want 7 hours as our minimum sleep. If you're trying to grow a body, get out of pain, get muscle, get lean, heal an injury, right? Learn a skill.
And that's probably not enough for most people in reality. Like that's table stakes.
Table stakes. And I said, real magic starts to happen if those are your goals towards 8 hours.
And sometimes I also follow that up with, just so people understand, that doesn't mean 7 hours or 8 hours in bed either. It means, in this case, 7 or 8 or even maybe even 9 hours of actual sleep. Because if you're blessed to get into bed, blackout unconscious within 5 minutes, and then just be in a coma all night long, and then...
Right, you haven't had any caffeine, alcohol, THC, stress, blue light, whatever it is.
Yeah, 7 or 8 hours later, you just pop out of bed, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Well, yeah. One, you're probably like 25 years old. I remember those days. I've emotionally accepted I may never sleep the entire night through ever again.
No, you won't. And you, at some point, you're going to be, I'm 50 this year, and every once in a while, I have to pee in the night, too. And I'm like, okay, well, that's over.
I'm dealing with, I don't want to hijack the conversation with just me babbling, but I was exposed to COVID again recently, which is not a big deal. It's going to happen. My wife got it traveling fine. And I've had it several times, and it's always been a mild illness. I almost didn't even notice it. Just felt like congested. Am I sick? I don't know. But I know that we had a nurse come over and just check her out because she had a bit of a fever. And then they did a test and she was positive. And then I did a test positive. Okay, fine. And so the illness itself was mild. However, I've now dealt with this twice. The after effect, that two things that I noticed. One is it messes my sleep up. And I've now done some reading, and this is a common side effect. It even has an informal term, COVID insomnia. And I've had it before and it was pretty bad. It was like an actual insomnia. I'd have trouble falling asleep. And then I might wake up every hour or every 2 hours. I might wake up.
This is good to know. I actually haven't, believe it or not, I have not heard of this. I've heard of all so many other things.
Oh, this is a thing. There's now research on it. It is a thing. It is one of the most common side effects is sleep disruption following COVID. And it can happen to anyone. Again, the illness for me is very mild. I'm a pretty healthy guy. I don't really even have any unhealthy habits to speak of. Not to say I'm perfect, but like I don't drink alcohol. I don't smoke. I eat well. I sleep. I exercise. I do all the things. And it really screwed up my sleep many months ago. And then this second time around, I've been dealing with a bit of sleep disruption again, not as bad, but in addition to that. So like last night, I woke up probably every two and a half hours because I had to pee. Like I actually pee pretty badly. And that is also a fairly common side effect, or it is a known side effect that you get an overactive bladder, that COVID can, the long COVID mysterious phenomenon can include an overactive bladder. So
well, what's great about your story, and thank you for sharing that, because those are two things I don't think people are aware of, but the hits are going to come and your sleep is going to be disrupted. And that's okay. You're going to have a baby. You'll have a deadline. You'll have to jump on a red eye. You'll travel. You'll sleep on a weird bed. You won't want to go to sleep because you're so freaked out or sketched out. But then you've got to come back down and try to get back to baseline. It's like saying, well, if my blood pressure, decent blood pressure is 120 over 80, and that's a benchmark or a vital sign. If I'm running, you know, really high blood pressure for a while, you can probably tolerate that, but then you need to bring it back down. Because, and 120 over 80 isn't great blood pressure, by the way. That's just the benchmark for, we're like, hey, what's going on with you? And that post we put up, 3 or 4 million views. And now what we're seeing, we left the comments open because we're so interested in seeing people's reactions to this, that people can't sleep 7 hours. It's bullshit. No one sleeps that much. No one who's successful sleeps that much. That everyone knows that in order to hustle and get by, it's 4 hours. If you read the comments, some of them are very personal. My new favorite self-moniker is Dr. Flatbill, because I was wearing a hat in there. So I'm Dr. Flatbill. And people are like, well, look at you. You look terrible. You're sleeping that way and you look like an ass. But what's really interesting is that outside this vertical where the WHO, World Sleep found it, like any person is like 7 to 8. And for children, it's actually more. And then the research around getting less sleep is pretty gnarly in terms of injury prevention.
And then performance as well, especially in athletics. I mean,
100%. And, you know, suddenly we're at this interface where we've told this lie that, you know, you don't need sleep. That's a badge of honor. And I thought we were post that, but outside our vertical, we haven't told that story very well and made the case for it. And now we have this opportunity. It's called youth sports, and that we're really having to say, hey, parents and kids, if you're serious about making the roster, I need to see your sleep scores. You know, and that means you need to be in bed with no phone. So it really gives us this organizing schema to talk about these things and talk about the things that we're seeing that we're getting wrong in our own generation, right? Because that's really what we should theoretically be doing, is course correcting back and forth, back and forth until we start to see fewer perturbations in the global system because we've run an experiment. And now because of the internet, we can aggregate and understand all of the experts.
And I agree with putting a lot of emphasis on children and on parents and raising children, because that is the future of our species. And there are situations that can get so bad that there's always something that can be done about it. But if we're talking about individual health, whether it's physical health, mental health, physical ability, mental ability, let's just say that you can dig a hole that's so deep that it can be very, very difficult to ever climb out of. However, if we would have taken that same person and rewind to when they were a child and raised them or helped them become raised, help them get raised differently and maybe not develop certain issues at an early age that then become very hard to correct as time goes on, you could have a very different person.
Yeah. And the real question then is, where's that vehicle? And that since we mandate that kids go to school, for me, it seems like that's the place to be able to have this kind of level of conversation and then appreciate that. I think, you know, and I know, you know, this MO we've developed where the glacial pace is the breakneck pace, that if we're going to see change in society, it takes a long time. Where we are as a strength and conditioning community now versus where we were 10 years ago is pretty phenomenal in the view of, wow, we've gotten a lot more sophisticated and complex in 10 years. And some of that complexity has blinded us. You know, there's a lot of NO explode and pre-workout and silliness, as we had talked about when we started. And yet simultaneously, you know, Juliet and I, you know, we describe ourselves on podcasts as diet survivors. You know, we like low fat, zone, paleo, keto, like all in the name of performance. But really, I keep coming back that we see the big trends even kind of be pushed backwards in society, really have started in the strength and conditioning. I think we're seeing a revolution in whole food nutrition to fuel sport that is backing its way out. We're seeing, you know, fewer protein shakes. Maybe it's because the magazines don't exist anymore. Fewer protein shakes, more whole food. And people have been talking about that forever, but because it's this top-down approach, you know, Tour de France, I would say, you know, and some of the professionals, you know, soccer and rugby has been the leaders of saying, hey, when we feed our athletes actual food and they sit together, we tend to do better.
I don't know. That sounds pretty pretty extreme, pretty fringe.
The whole food agenda. Yeah, Kelly is, Starrett is selling the idea that we should have dinner together.
Big Ag is trying to convince you to eat more of their toxic plants full of anti-nutrients.
You know, I heard a story. I have a relationship with the 49ers, and two seasons ago, they made the commitment to put a chef on site year-round for their players. And what they recognized was that athletes, from a performance perspective, that if athletes could get fed in whole foods and didn't have to cook and clean, they would come do it. So it gave reason for people to stick around, which changed culture, which gave them a reason to be in the building and then to go to the weight room and go on, you know, and all they needed to do was feed. And it was part of their contract. And it was not an insignificant amount of money investment. Basically, the cost of a rookie player to have a great chef to run that thing. And simultaneously, we have young athletes who have maybe come out of high school and college who didn't learn the skills of how to cook, didn't learn the skills of how to nurture themselves with food or create culture or identity around it because of the lack of that in their families or lack of emphasis for whatever reason, suddenly being able to get those needs met instead of defaulting to their training, which could have been, you know, I'm eating fast food. We saw the same thing happen with Arsenal. Arsenal suddenly had meals delivered from Harrods to the players. And some of the people were like, wait, we're sending dinner to 22-year-old millionaires? And they were like, yes, because they will default to chips and curry and, you know, they won't eat good food. And yet when someone delivers you vegetables, you know, great carbohydrate sources, lean proteins, you'll eat them 100% of the time. Like if I bring you a bespoke meal, you're like, thanks. I mean, that's my life ambition, is to be able to have an in-house chef. I don't know how much money Juliet and I have to make.
I suspect it could be more affordable than you might think if you actually, we could turn this into a semi-meal prep thing. Now, if you want a live-in chef to make you whatever you want, okay, now you need to write more books.
a lot more stretching videos. And what we're finding is, you know, some of the work I've seen in the Navy and some of the Army upper tier units, they found that their warfighters were eating one or two meals together a day. And that they, when they did that, they found better unit cohesion. And turns out, guess what? People who eat together, you know, Juliet says, you know, maybe she probably cribbed this from you. Human beings only really do two things. We move together and we eat together. So where are you doing that? And suddenly you start to see that there are these overarching patterns that are emerging through the data set, which is, by the way, the definition of the scientific method, right? Sir Francis Bacon is like induction through large pattern, like understanding the principles driven by looking at large data sets. That is the scientific method. When we then can be clever enough to say, okay, what does that look like? How can I make that work in my family unit? You know, that's really, really powerful. And that's how I think we're going to transform society and give ourselves common cause, because our children are going to go to school together and play sports together. And now we can all at least unify around what's best for our kids.
It's a great message and a great vision, one that I also believe strongly in, even though most of my work, I'd say, is more geared toward young adults to middle-aged adults and beyond, and is skewed toward body composition. But I also do work in a lot about overall health, overall performance, longevity. And again, openly acknowledging that 50% of the reason that I am still in the gym 3 days a week currently, I do cardio on my other days, but is to look a certain way. I don't think there's any shame in that. But there is another 50% that doesn't involve like abs and biceps.
I don't mind looking jacked, as if, you know, I don't mind being the jacked dad at the sideline, but you can have multiple bottom lines. I think that's really where we're going. The problem is you don't win fitness. You don't win health. I mean, are you going to be 100 years old and you're only a success when you rip up your shirt on your deathbed and you're like, jacked abs, fools? You know what I mean? Like, is that what it is? Like,
what do they say? As long as you leave a big coffin, right? That's how you know you've won.
I haven't heard that, but I want a wide coffin. Like, you know, like, we can't fit this guy's lats in here. What's going on?
Yeah. You bury me massive, you know?
I guess we did have a high school football coach that said, let's get bigger than a house. Every day he'd be like, let's block the sun. Let's get bigger than a house. I appreciate that. You know, it's interesting then to say we're starting to get a lot of overwhelm because we're seeing so many tools and tactics, I think. And then people have, you know, created listicles out of those things. And they're very much dilettantes in all of those fields.
I'm thinking of all the Twitter thread boys that just regurgitate people's listicles.
That's so cool. It's listicle. And when we I think can do a better job of giving framework to that, what's most essential, what is fun and entertaining. Look, I like getting in cold water. I like getting in the heat. I find that it breaks me. Like, it doesn't matter how stressed I am, I get hot and cold. There's no reset necessary. I'm just like, well, I got hot and cold and now I need to go to bed because I'm knackered. But I also see those things as not practical, not scalable, you know what I mean? And very much entertainment. Like, this is entertaining. I really like this. And I'm sure there's another way where I can take a shower. Most people are taking showers or getting hot and cold every day. When we can do a better job, and I just shine the light back on our cohort of coaches and friends, are we making it better and easier for people to understand this? Or are we adding to the bullshit noise? And let's figure out which one of these problems I've contributed to, and let me try to solve it. You know, you don't need an hour of rolling around on a foam roller and hooking yourself to a band. That was never our intention. And yet people went crazy. They stopped lifting, started running, and started mobilizing. And I'm like, hold up.
Or doing like 45-minute prehab sessions before they go and squat 135 or something, you know?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Hey, that's really heavy these days. So you're really on it. And I think when it's sometimes a degree that we overran our coverage a little bit. We got a little over our skis. And I think we're seeing a little bit of correction, because when we ask, and you know, I really appreciate that we kind of started talking about kids. I just saw some statistics about, and an article about, this epidemic of ACL injury rates in kids right now, that it's insane. And when we started even doing a straw poll in our house of kids, people who are in their 40s and 50s, I'm like, how many of your classmates had ACL tears? And it was like one, but the kid got slide tackled, and it was really a fluke thing. And now we're seeing that there's two per team per season, and that, like, it's really There's an ER here at UCSF that does 24-hour rotations of ACL repairs in kids. And the research of you, I was just over at Cal Berkeley talking to their sports med department, and they said now they have enough data that if you've injured your ACL in high school, we can guarantee you another lower extremity injury in college. Like, it's 100% correlation between having another one. So suddenly you're like, whoa, is this incomplete rehab after a surgery? Is this underlying situations that we haven't ever addressed? You know, sleep, nutrition, bone density, movement control, all the things that go into it. And suddenly you're like, third-party validation is the only way we can understand our work. And if our work is this trillion-dollar industry of fitness, then third-party validation should be, we should be less gross, less fat, less diabetic, less dependent on substance abuse, less depressed. I mean, choose something that, you know, you and your family care about because you're battling that, and ask, have we been served by the internet of fitness? And I don't think we have. So walk around any middle school, high school sport event, especially these club activities. So you go to club volleyball and look what the parents have put out. They've gone to Costco and they've done the minimalist they can, and they put out 20,000 calories of croissants, and everyone gets a Jamba Juice after playing volleyball for 20 minutes. And suddenly you're like, hold up. Like, this is not the zombie apocalypse. You know, one year I was so fed up with our daughter's club and the nutrition that was happening, where we're having a lot of conversations, and Juliet and I were, you know, saying, hey, here's how we fuel so we don't see these crashes. There was a girl there who had this breathing disorder. She would get super panicky, and she had really hard parents on her, and she would start to, you know, go numb, and her hands would get all tingly, and she'd breathe into a bag, and she would eat like a trash can and then crash. And then her parents would give her Cliff blocks. They'd give her gummy bears, these sugar blocks, and then she'd be back up and then she'd crash again. And, you know, when we said, hey, here's what we know, and again, not us, but here's what we know from the All Blacks and from the people we're working with around fueling so that we don't have this. And what I did instead was, I was like, let me take over the table. So for Far Westerns, I went up there and I had peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and all the cold cuts and 10 different fruits and ways that, and when the kids were presented with all of these options, there was something for everyone. And it was a little bit more difficult for me to have to plan and to put these things out and make it beautiful. But what we gave was, we still honored the choice. We had kids who were vegans and they had choices, and kids who, you know, had really narrow palates and they had choices. Any choice they made was still a better choice than the crappy quick bar, the Gatorade, the thing. And I think what we have to do is start to say, if I get 15 years of that, 20 years of that, and that's what I've learned. You know, like, we had this project for a while called Death to the Juice Box, because we'd see kids come into these birthday parties and they'd be like, where's that juice box? Where's that juice box? Like little crackheads. And we're like, no juice boxes here, but here's some water out of a cup, you know, that you can get. And we put some lemon water in here. You know, suddenly, you know, it really was a little bit of a paradigm shift. And that's why I think we have this real opportunity to bring everyone else along. And the book that we just wrote really is about establishing some benchmarks. Here's some vital signs that the research supports, that there is good data on. And let's go ahead and create a leveling effect. And then if you find yourself having a blind spot or you didn't know, let's become curious about that and bring you along. And it turns out, I think the body is so resilient that it's never too late. But, you know, we're seeing the epidemic of, you know, this weight loss drug, Ozempic, that's going around. We're seeing people in hospital. We have two friends who are, you know, working ERs. They've seen people hospitalized on Ozempic. They've seen people hospitalized on off-brand Ozempic they bought in Mexico, which is super sketchy. And what we have to understand is that for people who are so conditioned down the line, that may be a tool temporarily until we can get them walking, until we get them sunshine, until we can show them that apples aren't too much sugar, right? And I think it's going to take us a second. And as you and I have highlighted already, boy, it sure is easier to catch kids than to, you know, catch someone who's 30 or 40.
One of the easiest ways to increase muscle and strength gain is to eat enough protein and to eat enough high quality protein. Now, you can do that with food, of course. You can get all of the protein you need from food, but many people supplement with whey protein because it is convenient and it's tasty, and that makes it easier to just eat enough protein. And it's also rich in essential amino acids, which are crucial for muscle building, and it's digested well, it's absorbed well. And that's why I created Whey Plus, which is a 100% natural grass-fed whey isolate protein powder made with milk from small sustainable dairy farms in Ireland. Now, why whey isolate? Well, that is the highest quality whey protein you can buy. And that's why every serving of Whey Plus contains 22 grams of protein with little or no carbs and fat. Whey Plus is also lactose free, so that means no indigestion, no stomach aches, no gassiness. And it's also 100% naturally sweetened and flavored, and it contains no artificial food dyes or other chemical junk. And why Irish dairies? Well, research shows that they produce some of the healthiest, cleanest milk in the world. And we work with farms that are certified by Ireland's Sustainable Dairy Assurance Scheme, SDSAS, which ensures that the farmers adhere to best practices in animal welfare, sustainability, product quality, traceability, and soil and grass management. And all that is why I have sold over 500,000 bottles of Whey Plus and why it has over 6,000 4- and 5-star reviews on Amazon and on my website. So if you want a mouth-watering, high-protein, low-calorie whey protein powder that helps you reach your fitness goals faster, you want to try Whey Plus today. Go to buylegion.com/whey. Use the coupon code MUSCLE at checkout and you will save 20% on your first order. And if it is not your first order, you will get double reward points. And that is 6% cash back. And if you don't absolutely love Whey Plus, just let us know and we will give you a full refund on the spot. No form, no return is even necessary. You really can't lose. So go to buylegion.com/whey now. Use the coupon code MUSCLE at checkout to save 20% or get double reward points. And then try Whey Plus risk-free and see what you think. And I'm glad you brought up your new book, which is Built to Move. Now, you mentioned these vital signs. Can you tell us a bit more about these? What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, is that Julian and I felt that we hadn't invited or create fitness is real. If you, I mean, you're in our fitness cult, and I don't mean CrossFit, I mean fitness. Like you walk around the neighborhood in a weight vest and you know, like you're a freak. That's right. I mean, I see it. I mean, you have a Concept 2 bike in your house. So one of the things that we recognize is that people have gotten the message about diet and exercise, but that doesn't seem to be sufficient given this third-party validation. And one of the things that we have always tried to do is say, let's look at sport as a laboratory where we can understand good practices under the microscope of real pressure. One of my favorite coaches is Frans Bosch. He's this Dutch mad scientist. In his writing, he says, there's more variation in waltzing than there is in sprinting. Which means that at low load, low speed, low stress, you can do you. You can do whatever you want with that foot. You can do whatever you want with that knee. You can do whatever you want with that back. But at high load, high speed, high intensity, we start to see best practices and expressions of the body really start to look similar. And the differences are really strategy or the length of my limb, not what is really going on. The best bench pressers in the world all bench press the same way. Look at how tennis players serve. There's some variation, but not a lot of variation. You know, you'll start to see that when sprinters are sprinting, they all very much sprint alike and they start alike. And they use different strategies to get there, but the homogenization of the expression of highest sort of output really starts to look alike. So if we can take those lessons, then we can transmute them into our lessons for our families and our communities, that we shouldn't just make sport circus, that we could actually derive some lessons there. So this is based on all our work there and simultaneously recognizing that when we say get sleep, everyone's like, I sleep great. I'm like, can I see how much sleep you're getting? Oh, you don't sleep great. You know, so when we started giving people a clear benchmark and especially the athletes we were working with, can I see everything that you ate today? Can I see how much sleep you actually got written down? Can I talk about all of these other things? We suddenly realized that we had a sort of a two bucket category. The first bucket was, what are the behaviors that allow us to create durability? Nutrition for me was always about fueling. I didn't ever want to talk about nutrition for body composition. I was like, boring.
And it actually can be at odds with performance. I mean, I recently recorded a podcast on energy availability and some research about 40 to 45 calories per kilogram of lean mass per day is going to be much better for longevity and particularly for performance than say 30 or even 25. But the 30 and 25 might be great for getting shredded and maybe staying shredded because you just don't move around as much when you're shredded and you don't feel very good generally, but you're shredded. You can be athletic and look great. But you know, I thought of this when you were talking about bodybuilding earlier, that it encourages a look that is not healthy for most people and certainly not good for people who want to perform at their best.
One of the two-time world champions that I'm supporting right now was talking about losing some weight in the middle of the season for a specific event. And I said, that's a horrible idea. Let's not have you have low energy availability and expose you to this theoretical change where maybe 1 or 2 kilos comes off you. And yet simultaneously you know, I'm like, it's a lot easier for us to keep you fed and sleeping and feeling good and tweaking your training a little bit during this next 6 weeks, right? Or even 3 weeks, we can kind of touch a couple energy systems and just get things back on board. And you're absolutely right. So I think when I had to talk about nutrition, I was like, well, if you want to have healthy tendons, you've got to have all the building blocks for the tendons. So suddenly I realized, you know, that 1 gram of protein per pound body weight for injuries, for healing, that's the benchmark that we give out because that's what the science supports. And suddenly I was like, well, I have to suddenly become kind of competent in this domain. The other handful of our range of motion domains, because what we hadn't done is Juliet and our failure through the ready state is to make stretching or range of motion, make people care about it. Because we know that you can buffer some really ineffective positions and not have access to your range of motion and still be good. Juliet's a 3-time world champion, has terrible ankle dorsiflexion. She will tell you that rowing in college and paddling whitewater class 5 did not require Olympic lifting level dorsiflexion. So she was able to, you know, go around and still be exceptional. So it's not about being exceptional. It's about saying, how can we start to give people benchmarks around maintaining their movement windows so that they can age well, pick up skills well, right? And potentially stave off movement dysfunction in terms of pain, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what we tried to do. And I think we did a better job this time with some of the movement assessments by helping people understand, oh, I can't do this thing. I should be able to do this very normative baseline thing. And when we finally said, hey, don't look at range of motion out of context, let's give it context for a skill, I think we made them more of a case for it.
And that, in my experience, is exactly what many people have reached out to me have needed is what's a simple self-assessment that you can go through that actually puts the emphasis on the things that warrant the emphasis, as opposed to maybe on things that just sound kind of exotic, make for good marketing. Okay, so I've done my little self-assessment here and my results, and now what can I do? So there seems to be a deficit in these areas. What do I do about it?
And in my home, right?
Yes. Well, I was just going to say, what do I do about it? And how can I do it at home in probably no more than 15 minutes a day? Because if you ask me to do stretches and mobility drills for 30 minutes a day, it's much less likely to happen, especially if I'm also doing some workouts and have a life to live.
Especially because I want you to have a life. That's exactly right. And it's taken us a minute to sort of gather that up to say, we actually think you can make yourself feel better and keep an eye on your range of motion in 10 minutes in home. And you don't need very many tools. And when we start to give people consistency, right? Our friend, you know, Lane Norton, you know, to quote Lane, you know, what you don't need is consistency for 3 months or 6 months or a year. You need bone crushing consistency for years. And boy, it's really hard for me to wrap my head around that. And I know that that's the rule. But, you know, this 21-day reset, this 7-day toxic, thing or blast my abs in 14 days, that sold me that I could get everything I wanted very quickly versus the bone crushing consistency of, you know, one of my friends is Matt Vincent, who is a 2-time Highland Games world champion. And someone said, hey, Matt, how do you get strong? And he was like, why don't you lift something heavy once a week for 10 years? Let me know how that goes. And let me know if you end up getting strong. And someone's like, 10 years? And you're like, yes, that's the time scale we're working on. That's why it's easier to start as a kid. Because you're like,
the only thing I've done for 10 years consistently, masturbate. So, all right, this is not for me.
You know, I think when we then take the lens of, okay, these small behaviors that I can fit in. It doesn't have to be an hour long class. I don't have to commit my, you know, my soul to the void in order to do these things. I can actually have much greater interventions if I start to look at a movement practice as extending from when I wake up to when I go to bed. And, you know, even restoration, for example, one of our first things that we give people is to sit on the ground in the evening. So what we want you to do tonight, if you're listening to this, is to watch the first 30 minutes of television sitting on the floor in front of the couch. We know you're watching TV because the research says 1 to 3 hours. And we know that Silo is an amazing television show. So, and The Witcher is back on and all the other fun shows. So just sit on the ground. What you'll see is that, yeah, that long sitting is uncomfortable. Then you sit side saddle and then you're long, you know, then you're 90-90 and then you're kneeling. And then if you look around the ground, you're like, oh, there's my roller. And so you can just, I just did 10 minutes of whatever was hurting in that moment. And then if we rinse, wash, repeat that for 5 to 7 days a week, you can get massive amounts of input in, and you've created context for that behavior. And now we're actually really finally helping people versus go down to your local stretch lab, get a membership, you know, add another complex intervention. Don't get me wrong, those things are awesome, but going to the sauna every 3 weeks is not the intervention we're looking for. I'm like, what can we do day after day after day in a really repetitive way to keep an eye on these minimums?
That little habit stack is nice. I'm glad you mentioned that. That's what I do. I don't watch much TV. It's certainly not 3 hours, probably not even an hour. Some days it's nothing. Other days, maybe it's 30 minutes, watch something with my wife. But start almost always with, there are a handful of stretches that I've been doing over the years, an internal rotation stretch for the left side of my hips in particular, just because it was quite bad years ago and it's improved. And just a few things, open up my shoulders and whatever. And it gets done probably on average 5 days per week. Some days I'm perfect and it's 7 days, some days it's 6 weeks, but on average, it's probably 5 days. And often it's at night. Okay, we're going to watch some TV. I'm going to start with, it's no more than 10 minutes. It's probably closer to 6-7 minutes. And I'll go through my little stretching routine. And it's not physically demanding. I wouldn't want to do something that starts to feel like a workout at 9 p.m. or whatever. But it's just, I've gotten used to, whether I'm watching TV or not, at night, I'm done with everything. My kids are in bed. Okay, my wife and I are going to spend a little bit of time together, sit down, do my little stretches. And it's been very easy to maintain by just combining it with something else I'm going to do anyway.
You said something that I really like there, I want to double click on, which is, you have your routine, which is your body. And what's really fun is when people start to explore this, they suddenly realize that there's a collection of positions or shapes that they spend time in, or they put the ball here for 2 minutes, because that's their sort of unique thing based on their body, their, you know, anthropometry and their environment and their history. And suddenly, you know, the 3 or 4 things you just got to keep an eye on. And if you do that, you end up feeling better. And so it's a lot easier just to, if you're going to take and break a credit card, we just want to fold the credit card thousands of times, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then eventually gets a crease and you can access those positions. And your brain is saying, man, you spent a lot of time here. Let's make sure we value that. And let's support you continuing to value that. Or, you know, you engage in a sport like cycling, which takes away your hip extension. So suddenly you're like, I got to keep an eye on my hip extension, my ability to extend my hip, not like in a pedal stroke, but actually get my knee behind my butt. Hashtag knees behind butt guy. And what we're trying to get everyone on the board of the hip extension train. But what's really great though, is that you suddenly have your secret compendium, but that secret compendium also can serve you as a template for something that hurts. You know, that when something pops up because you tried something new or you got behind or you overdid it or whatever, you're a human being and suddenly your knee hurts a little bit, you're like, oh, I have a template and a schema to self-soothe as the first order of operation. And I think that's what's really powerful here, is suddenly we're not just reaching for bourbon or ibuprofen. And I think it was 2008, I wrote an article on our blog, which already makes me sound old. Let's get off the ibuprofen, people. Like, peoples, let's get off the ibuprofen. And the pushback on that was profound. That was the first time I was like, oh, there's a third rail. Like, you know, you can have my ibuprofen, you pry it from my cold, dead hands. People were like, no, ibuprofen is life. And yet we see now that this whole peace and love acronym that helps us, but the A in peace and love, which is like protect, elevate, et cetera, is avoid anti-inflammatories. Because we saw that they delayed healing and led for less effective healing of the tissues because they interrupted our healing response, even though they took my pain away. And so I'm like, I'd rather you know, I mean, are you reaching for bourbon? Are you reaching for, like, unless we give you some strategies for this, you're going to go to your training or your experience And if it's ibuprofen and bourbon, you know, your liver's going to hate you, but your knee won't hurt for a while. So I think...
Until one day, your knee probably won't knee anymore, but...
That's right. It won't knee anymore. Like, that's so great. So it takes a while for us to evolve our positions. And certainly I came out of, you know, PT school where it was 800 milligrams of ibuprofen 3 times a day. You know, that was what we knew, that that could make anyone feel better. But boy, that ankle instability that you still have is a bitch. I don't know why that you sprained your ankle and now it's chronically unstable. Well, it turns out that 2,400 milligrams of ibuprofen really did a number on breaking that connection between your body and its healing response. So again, we're getting wiser and smarter, but now you and I are thinking always critically, when and where are mortals who have busy jobs, who are worried about their day-to-day or just trying to keep their lights on in their house and their kids fed, where are they going to begin this conversation?
I mean, something that I try to keep in mind just for general messaging and in my work is that there are many people out there who won't even consistently take a medication that they need to save their life. So, and then that's not a judgment on those people. It's just understanding where a lot of people are at. Now, maybe those types of people don't generally find their way into our orbit, but the number is not zero. And when they do, at least I think we're saying the same thing here, that we want to make sure that we're meeting them where they are at. And, you know, in my case, for example, put out this message in many different ways where, and I've even given it to people personally, like via email and so forth. I'm speaking to somebody who's in that kind of condition. I would love for them just to go out for a walk every day. Let's start there on the exercise because they're not moving around much. They get 2,000 steps per day. Okay, can we increase that? Just increase the activity. And if they're up for a change in their diet, can we go with less soda? Can we replace some of the sugar sweetened maybe with diet soda? Let's just start there. And let's see if we can ingrain those habits until they're frictionless. And then maybe we'll add a little bit more walking. And then maybe we'll try to add a little bit of protein or add one serving of vegetables and just work incrementally until we have a whole new person. And it really can work like that. So, you know, it's just something that I try to keep in mind when giving general advice, that it doesn't matter that 3 to 5 hours of strength training per week plus 3 to 5 hours of cardiovascular exercise per week plus 100% of calories coming from whole relatively unprocessed foods. So yeah, fine. This is what people have been hearing for a long time, but it doesn't cause them to change their behaviors. And so then what does? And the tiny habit approach I've found resonates with people.
Juliet and I believe that everyone who's in the strength and conditioning or fitness, which is not even a word I really like, but we're here, we're doing it. If this is us, we're sort of obsessed with this. It's part of our identity. We really enjoy it. I really enjoy training. You know, I'm going to train until I can't train. You know, what am I training for? To be the best middle-aged mountain biker in the neighborhood. Like, you know what I mean? Like, which is a terrible biker. But if you're listening to this, we are counting on you to become a node in your community. And one of the reasons we wrote this book was we recognized that a lot of people don't know where to start. And what you just heard was a treatise on the small behaviors. And that's when someone in your family is interested, that's the approach to take. Because what you're doing and the way you live your life, you might as well be an alien from another planet. You'd like to do what? You haven't even suffered. I mean, you experienced this, Michael, that when you put people in an ice bath for the first time, they freak out. And that's because they don't know the feeling of suffering and of pain. And when I put my elite cyclists in an ice bath for the first time, they're like, oh, this just feels like Tuesday when during the middle of my intervals where I'm on fire and it's a different kind of fire. This is better. I like this easier because I'm not even bleeding through my eyes. So when you start with this small approach, that's how we do it. And what we try to do with this book is create a resource for all the coaches who now are having to have this conversation with so many of their athletes who are saying, hey, I really want to respect the time we have together where we can actually train and I can load and we can work on these things, but I need you to get ready for that. So read this. Or I have this uncle who's overweight and doesn't know where to start. This is the book to invite them on the journey that you take for granted because you are already a black belt and people are like, wait, how do I tie the belt? I mean, they're afraid to tie the belt. You're already a black belt. So, I mean, we can't say that enough. And by the way, all of the things you suggested are all the things that I do. You know, I don't drink sugar sodas. You know, I don't drink drinks with calories. I really do try to walk more. I try to, you know, get some more protein. I mean, what I love about first principles is that they scale up and scale down. What I am less a fan of are interventions and strategies that are cul-de-sacs. I do this for a while and I can't get better. You know, I don't remember who described it. Heard recently someone talking about, like, you don't get better than the guitar, right? You just keep playing and playing and playing and playing. Movement, nutrition, all of these things are open-ended and can be regressed and progressed as needed. And once we start to view those habits in that lens, then it's just an issue of, you know, applying the rubber to the road for enough time, because it always works. It 100% works.
I love it. Well, this was a great interview as expected. And again, the book is Built to Move. I want to thank you again for taking the time, Kelly. And before we wrap up here, is there anything else that you wanted to share? Anything that I should have asked that I didn't ask?
It's never too late. Bring your friends along. I think the next sort of barrier is we've got to get people back outside.
I mean, I second that. That's another thing that is just, as when I was mentioning my flag football coaching experience versus my experience as a kid playing sports, going, I don't remember it being exactly like this. So I'm in this neighborhood here in Florida. And so when I was a kid, I was always outside and there were always kids in the neighborhood. And all we did was play one sport or do one athletic sporty type thing after another. It was skateboarding, then it was inline rollerblading, then it was BMX biking, and then it was roller hockey and blah, blah, blah. And so I'm in this neighborhood with, I don't know, a couple hundred houses, probably it's a pretty big neighborhood. And there was one boy who he left, and I've not seen another boy. I never see kids. And I've taken my son, like, okay, let's get in the car. There got to be some kids outside playing. It's, you know, Saturday and it's 2 p.m. or 3 p.m. or whatever. Let's go drive around trying to find him, like, some kids to play with. And we've done it a couple of times. Nothing. And I've asked now other parents, like, are there kids here? Oh yeah, there are some kids. Why do I never see them? They're just inside all day. Then there's one kid that he meets and the mom does not allow the kid to go outside. Like, she didn't openly say that, but it's clear at this point, this kid is not allowed to go outside and play. For my son to be able to play with him, he has to go over to their house. She doesn't even allow him to come over here. My son has to go to their house and they are inside and that's it.
In San Francisco, we've seen a rise of what we call subclinical rickets, where kids are falling off a bunk bed like 2 feet and breaking forearms and smashing collarbones. And you're like, what's that about? You know, when they sent my daughter home, and I know we're going on and on, when they sent, Caroline was a preemie and spent 3 weeks in the NICU. When they sent her home, this is my 5'10 Hulk, by the way, they were like, you have to give her these vitamins. And I was like, she's breastfeeding. I don't need to give her vitamins. And they were like, no, you got to give her these vitamins. And I was like, look me in the eye and tell me the breast milk is not the perfect food for my child. I'm like, go ahead. I'm a doctor. Just tell me your rationale. And they got so uncomfortable. And I was like, go ahead. I'm just waiting. And they're like, I was like, what's the problem with the breast milk? And they're like, there's no vitamin D in it because the mothers in San Francisco don't go outside and they don't create any vitamin D in their skin to pass on their kids. So I was like, oh, so if I take my kid and put her in the sun, I don't have to give her this complex solution to a problem that rhymes with the sun. And they were like, that's correct. So, I mean, we're seeing this up and down, and there's 10,000 analogies of that. You're right. Like, here's a kid who doesn't go outside, isn't allowed to for whatever reason. And suddenly we just tumble on into all the original conversations, which is, how are we going to create and use sport? Because now sport gives us a reason to go outside to transform our communities. And again, training, which is lovely and so important and saves lives. Theoretically, we learned to train because we were doing a sport.
Especially as a kid. It was fun to play the sport. Training for the sport could be fun, but it was in service of what was really fun. Well, this was great, Kelly. And quickly, why don't you just let people know where they can find you and find your work so they can check out everything else you're up to?
Yes, we are at The Ready State. And that's all across the socials, at The Ready State. If you are interested, we have, I think, the world's greatest self-assessment mobility test on our app. There's a free trial over there. We have daily follow-along mobility drills. It's super, super simple to get involved. And what we've tried to do is actually democratize this thing. We really believe that we appreciate that people are struggling. Not everyone has infinite money to, you know, dump onto their health. But here is something that we know that if we can get enough people on, it becomes a scale and we can put more resources into it. And we really think that the Ready State app is the place where you can begin a conversation with getting to know yourself a little bit better, especially if you're in pain.
I love it. I've been a fan of your work since I came across Supple Leopard many years ago, and I've enjoyed to see how it has evolved in this direction of just making it more accessible and meeting people where they're at, giving them simple things that they can do. The 20% that gives you the 80%. If we can just focus on doing those things just well enough. I'll agree with Lane that you need the bone-crushing consistency if you want to be a world champion powerlifter. I'll give him that. But if you don't, maybe just like slightly uncomfortable amount of consistency, just enough of the right things is enough to be in outstanding shape, outstanding health, and to avoid so many of the issues that plague so many people in our society.
Yeah. And I'll just sum up by saying, you know, that your work is always about playing offense, not playing defense. You're not saying do these things, otherwise X. You're saying if you do these things, you'll show up for your family more intact. You'll have more energy on the weekend. You'll be a more effective lover. And but I think when we help realize that people probably can get even more out of their lives and feel better and have more fun, then it's sticky. And that really is what we're trying to do here. We're trying to point positive.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kelly. I really appreciate your work and I appreciate your time.
Well, I hope you liked this episode. I hope you found it helpful. And if you did, subscribe to the show because it makes sure that you don't miss new episodes. And it also helps me because it increases the rankings of the show a little bit, which of course then makes it a little bit more easily found by other people who may like it just as much as you. And if you didn't like something about this episode or about the show in general, or if you have ideas or suggestions or just feedback to share, shoot me an email, mike@muscleforlife.com, muscleforlife.com, and let me know what I could do better or just what your thoughts are about maybe what you'd like to see me do in the future. I read everything myself. I'm always looking for new ideas and constructive feedback. So thanks again for listening to this episode, and I hope to hear from you soon.